Good morning. The Ways and Means Committee will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. Thank you, everyone, for being here at this, for our committee anyway, early hour. We have the minutes of May 7th before us. Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. Are there any questions, additions, changes to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Okay, members, we have two items of business today, but before we go into them, let me just remind people we have an 8 a.m. meeting tomorrow as well, in which at this point we have posted to take up the hands-free bill and the constitutional amendment bill. And we're going to have a GOP Ways and Means huddle at 2 o'clock in room 400. And I don't know if 400 North. I don't know, Representative Carlson, if you've got any other announcements to make in terms of DFL huddles or anything. I figured I'd just get that out of the way now.
Your schedule, I think what we'll do is probably the same thing then.
Okay. All right.
Just
okay.
Coordinate the timing probably.
In 400 North. Yeah. Yeah. We can all huddle together. It's more efficient.
One party rule. I think we'd get in trouble with the rules if we huddled together. But
oh, that's probably true.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe for the benefit of, I think, just about all of us are here. We'll get together then at 2 o'clock and 272.
All right. Okay.
Same time you do.
All right. And then this, for those who are interested, that we'll be meeting, the Supplemental Conference Committee will be meeting this afternoon probably at 3 o'clock. I guess wait for an announcement on the floor. But we'll put that out for sure after committee in room 1200 in the Senate office building. And we'll be going through a lot of the language on the side-by-sides. So if there's no... Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Just like to point out the Pages are here today, so welcome to them.
Oh, yes, they are. Welcome, Pages. We got
all
of them
here.
Yeah,
Warren, Minnesota in the group, too. That's
yeah.
Nice.
Yep.
Kobe.
And one from St. Cloud.
I know. I got one from St. Cloud. Sarah. All right. Well, with that, let's bring Representative Clark Johnson forward. And Representative Johnson had to wait a long time for nothing the last meeting, so we'll try to get his bill done first. So, Representative Johnson, welcome to Committee on Ways and Means. The chair will move that House Call 3424 be referred to the General Register. And, Representative Johnson, there is a A6 amendment. Do we want to take that right now? Okay, chair will move the A6 amendment. Representative Johnson, can you describe the amendment?
The amendment does two things. It alters some language related to a sale up in Manoman County. I've spoken with Representative Green, who represents that area. He agrees to that language change. I thank him for that. And then there also one additional land transaction is added that came after the bill was heard in the previous committee.
All right. Any questions on that amendment? Seeing no questions, all in favor of the amendment, the A6 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
And opposed? Motion prevails. The A6 amendment is adopted. All right. Representative Johnson, can you describe the bill?
Mr. Chair and members, this is the lands bill for the Department of Natural Resources and fundamentally allows provides for land transactions with the state of Minnesota as well as local government units. It involves some fiscal impact of a positive nature in terms of some sales for a total of $1.339,300,000. So that's the bill. I think these are well vetted previously, and if you have any questions, I've asked Susan Damon, who's works with the DNR and handles these activities, to join me, and she can, I think, answer the questions you may have.
All right, members, discussion to the bill or questions for the author or the witness? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just thank you, Clark, Representative Johnson, for bringing this forward. It's a good bill. It's been through our committee, and he's done a nice job of being the chief author of the bill, and I urge a green vote.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and likewise, thank you, Representative Johnson, for bringing the bill. Just one question, Representative Johnson. What's the net number of acres sold in the bill?
Representative Johnson.
I'm going to ask my Susan Damon to answer that. I honestly don't know the total number of acres.
Ms. Damon, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. If you could state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you. Susan Damon, Assistant Director, Division of Lands and Minerals with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chair, members, unfortunately, I don't have a total of the net acres, but the DNR sale parcels are in Section 11, which is one acre, Section 12, 40 acres, Section 14, 2.4 acres, and then Section 15, 3.3 acres. And there are also a number of county tax forfeited sales. I don't have the total acres for those. I can get those for you if you would like, though.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Damon. Just to maybe point out to members, it sounds like there might be 50 acres or 100 acres sold, and we just passed a bill that bought another 6,500 acres. So just to give you an idea what the net number of acres of state-owned land is in this state through this session, we're likely going to be netting somewhere north of 6,000 net additional acres of state land purchased. The private side is losing, and the government side is winning. Thank you.
Other discussion to the bill? Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to thank Representative Johnson. You know, he sat through our entire meeting the other day, and we didn't get to the bill. But not all bills go as quickly as this one is this morning, as you observed the other day.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to point out, you know, the tax forfeit land sales that are in the bill. I know that this is an issue in northern Minnesota, and I appreciate the concern that many people have about the gains in terms of state land. But to a certain degree, a couple of counties have figured out that tax forfeit land is land that they manage. And working with the DNR, Roseau County and St. Louis County have actually sold a very, very significant number of acres into the private market. If more counties would take advantage of their ability to work with the DNR to move some of these tax forfeit lands, I think that they could do a lot for their tax base. And sometimes things down here get kind of, you know, lost in the fog and so forth, but they can actually be more proactive at the local level to reduce some of the public lands in their counties, and they can actually move them and put them back into private hands. So I encourage counties to take a long, hard look at that.
Other discussion to the bill? See no further discussion. I will renew my motion that House File 3424, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 3424, as amended, is referred to the General Register.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carlson.
Could I ask a question? The reference earlier to 6,000 acres being purchased, I don't remember a bill going through committee here that had that kind of purchase. Would that be the legacy bill that hasn't come through here yet? Or I'm just kind of curious what bill was being referenced.
Well, the legacy bill has come through here, Representative Carlson. I guess I don't recall the exact number of acres in it, but
well, that's right, it did. Didn't
Representative Druskowski?
Mr. Chair, I understand 6,500 acres, 6,500 acres of government land purchased in a legacy bill, which Representative Carlson is down from the average of 10 to 11,000 per year. For instance, last year was about 11,000, I think. And the average legacy purchase annually has been somewhere in the area of 10,000 acres of state land bought and taken from the private sector by the legacy bill.
Yeah, that's. I'd forgotten about the legacy bill, and then I got thinking maybe that was the one, but I forgot that it went through, quite frankly.
Well, it's been a while now. We've had a lot of other meetings, a lot of other
pretty,
bills.
Pretty quick when it went through. Very good. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Well, next we will be taking up the capital investment bill, which is House File 4404. And Representative Erdahl moves that House File 4404 be referred to the General Register. And Representative Erdahl, I know you've got a couple of author's amendments here, or at least one. Do you want to take up the A8 amendment first?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Erdahl moves the A8 amendment. Representative Erdahl, could you explain the amendment?
Just makes a few changes to the bill. We take $6 million from TED under deed and moves it to MnDOT for port development assistance. Insert the line 1.9 inserts an omission of construct for the Waukon Teepee Center. In 110, we have a correction adding design to the project description for the St. Cloud Prison Interior Fence Project. 113 to 115 adds in kind to be allowed for non-state contributions to Silver Bay. 116 to 17, in the PFA section, we add an earmark for the Albertville Wastewater Infrastructure Improvements Project. In 118, we correct the bond sale schedule. In Article 2, lines 21 to 26, we amend the percentage for arts to exclude the PFA-funded projects. 27 to 224, we add the governor's bill, from the governor's bill, the amendment to the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program to establish bond proceeds account. 225 to 3.9, we amend PSIG, PFA's point source implementation program to increase the maximum grant amount from $7 million to $9 million. It makes a conforming amendment to the section directing the PFA to report on need for the WIF and PSIG program. Line 310, MHFA housing infrastructure bonds definition of senior housing is amended to apply to persons 55 and older instead of 62 and older. And 311, we have the MHFA housing infrastructure bonds technical correction. In lines 3.12 to 4.2, we delete the water quality regulations review language in the bill and inserts a different approach. So those are the amendments contained in the A8. I do have a oral amendment also to that. Do you want to include that with the A8 or vote on that and do that separately?
Well, no, let's take that now and you can incorporate that, Representative Erdahl. Please state the oral amendment.
In line 3.16, after the word any, insert Minnesota Higher Education Institution or Municipal Joint Powers. So between any and municipal, insert Minnesota Higher Education Institution or.
All right. And members, you should have a copy of that that has been distributed to you. Well, Representative Erdahl, we'll just incorporate that into your amendment. Discussion to the A8, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erdahl, the one thing you do is the part about the $2 million grant to Albertville for wastewater. It seems that that proposal jumps Albertville ahead of other cities on the PFA list. Is that something we normally do here, or is this a brand new approach?
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Drazkowski, it's something that I'm reluctant to do those types of things. We like to stay with the PFA list. Albertville has a particular problem where they have to tear up their city streets. And they need, when they tear up the city streets, to install this pipe. We don't want them to have the street fixed and then have to come back and re-tear up the city street again to fix the pipe. So we needed to move that ahead. So you are correct. On a general principle, I don't like to do that. I like to stay with the PFA list, but we did talk with PFA about this, and this in this instance made sense to do it.
Representative Skulski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other discussion to the A8 amendment. I'm sorry, I had Representative Hausman and then Liebling. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erdahl, the lines on 2.4 to 2.6 was sort of surprised because I can't imagine that we've ever done that. So what's the necessity? It has to do with acquire works of art with PFA.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. And, you know, I like I don't mind having art in our public buildings, but in this particular case, there are a couple of things. One, we are trying to find ways to cut down the cost, and I know it's not a huge amount, but it's something. The cost to PFA projects, and secondly, I don't know, putting artwork in wastewater treatment facilities just didn't seem like a good idea.
Representative Halstman.
Chair, and I think we've never done it before. That's why I wondered why we Pardon me?
The provision is there to do it. You requiring artwork in PFA facilities.
Yeah, Representative Halstman, I've heard some, I think, confusion or mixed concerns about this from some people as to whether this is required or not, and I think that we want to make sure that people understand it's not required. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I thought there might be someone here who wanted to testify on this amendment. Molly Peterson, I've been told, wanted to testify. I wonder if that's the case,
We haven't received any notification of anyone wanting to testify other than Commissioner France and, I believe, the MPCA.
Okay.
And so I think that at this point we'll just plan on taking those two people that have already asked.
And, Mr. Chair, I'm talking about on the amendment, I think, not on the bill in total.
Yeah, okay. I'm speaking to the bill.
All right.
Other discussion, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erdahl, back to Representative Draskowski's comments about the project up there and the speech and so forth. Can you make a case that in the long run you're actually going to save the taxpayers money by jumping ahead? I don't like necessarily jumping ahead, but I do see from my perspective that in the long run we're actually going to save the taxpayers' dollars. Is that correct?
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Fabian, yes, that is correct, and that's what I was, I guess, trying to say, but not as eloquently as you just did. I didn't use the words, it will save the taxpayers' money. Yes.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erdahl, do we know how much?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Draskowski, no, I do not. No.
I would, Mr. Chair,
Representative Draskowski.
I'd appreciate the author's focus on that number next time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll check into that for you.
Other discussion of the A8 amendment. All right, seeing no further discussion, Representative Erdahl renews his motion to adopt the A8 amendment with the incorporated language on page 3, line 16. All in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A8 amendment is adopted.
And Mr. Chairman, I see we have distributed the A9 amendment, which I'd like to draw the attention of the members to. I think this is a very important issue. There's a blemish in the city of Bellwood that really needs to be demolished. Anyone have any comments about that?
Okay, Representative Erdahl moves the A9 amendment. I know we do in this bill occasionally demolish unneeded blighted properties. Is there any discussion to the A9 amendment?
Is that being coming now?
I understand this is a blighted property, isn't it, Representative
Erdahl? Yes, it is a blighted property.
And who owns this blighted property, Representative Erdahl?
I'm not...
You don't have the exact ownership.
Not the exact ownership.
What entity it is or what?
I think it's very close to Representative Dean's neighborhood.
Oh, it's Representative Dean.
maybe Representative Dean knows something about this property that he could explain.
Representative Dean. Can you enlighten us as to this property?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Erdahl. I'd speak against the A9 amendment, the adoption of the A9 amendment. It should be able to be demolished for less than $100,000, and I'm not sure it's worth it.
All right. I'll withdraw the amendment on that
advice. Representative Dean withdraws the amendment to Representative Erdahl withdraws his amendment to demolish Representative Dean's house.
contract to build it?
We have the A7 amendment. Representative Torkelson offers the A7 amendment. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A7 amendment has to do with trunk highway bonds. It's not unusual to carry trunk highway bonds in the capital investment bill. They do involve capital investment. The difference, of course, is that trunk highway bonds are serviced by the trunk highway fund. They don't they do not require a supermajority vote to pass, but it's been past practice to carry trunk highway bonds in the capital investment bill. This is what this amendment does. It brings them, puts them in another place, so to speak, besides the transportation bill itself. The language of this amendment pretty much mirrors what's in the transportation bill, $145 million for corridors of commerce, $75 million for rail-grade separation projects, $30 million for the transportation facilities capital account that is also created by the language in Section 3 of the amendment.
Discussion of the A7 amendment. Representative Houseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it is identical to what was in the transportation bill. I didn't understand. Yes, we often do trunk highway bonds in a bonding bill, but why would we have it in two places? I don't think I understood. I don't think I heard that in the explanation for why we're offering this. And one of the reasons I'm concerned is when you do this, you add a lot of extra weight and debt to this particular bill that the author then has to defend in another place, and a little inequity since we only do roads and not transit.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Houseman. You know, I do on occasion wear both a belt and suspenders just to be safe, and that is the reasoning behind this.
Other discussion of the A7 amendment? See no discussion. All in favor of the A7 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. The A7 amendment is adopted. I don't believe there are other amendments, so Representative Erdahl, could you present the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is, well, first of all, I want to thank the members of our committee that worked on this, Representative Houseman, Representative Charleston, and others. It's a geographically balanced bill. It's politically balanced in terms of Democrat, Republican. It is heavily focused on infrastructure. 38% of this bill is asset preservation, state-owned buildings. 13% deals with transportation. I suppose with this item on there, the percentage just jumped up. 16% on water and conservation. And the idea was to cover as much of the things that we own as we could with the target given us. And that's what we have attempted to do. You guys have spreadsheets? Well, what I'm going to do is go through my spreadsheet, which corresponds to what's in the written copy of the bill.
Okay, please do so.
All right. University of Minnesota, Minnesota State, we covered all of the requests that they made at the university. For the Minnesota State, we went about three-fourths of the way down their list. We kept it in order. In the priority ranking, I didn't move anyone around, didn't jump anyone. We did $40 million each for Minnesota State and for the university in Heber. Under education, I'll just, as I go through the spreadsheet, I'll highlight. I'm not going to read every item. We did school safety grants at $25 million. The Red Lake facility for, I don't know, half a dozen years has been making requests for needed repairs and renovation in their school. We have $14,492,000 for that. State academies, we did assets. We tried to do something in asset preservation wherever we could. Under the DNR, preservation, the acquisition and betterment of buildings is asset preservation as well. We have some money for improving accessibility to state parks. and some individual projects in here. In the PCA, we did $6 million for the Andover pit that we had begun to work on last time, and they needed more money to finish it. We have some funding for the Clay County Resource Recovery Center, and the very important here, the Redwood Lake Redwood Reclamation. For the Board of Water and Soil Resources in RIM, $10 million. We put $20 million, I don't know if I mentioned, in flood and land mitigation. Seidel's Lake included in this. To the Minnesota Zoo, $10 million. Under administration, we put in some funding for the Capitol Complex security upgrades. Military affairs, we had a list of armories. We, again, kept in order and funded the number one request for the armories of military affairs. Public safety, we have done some police training centers. Under transportation, the local road program, $72,321,000, that's about what we were informed they could do in 1 year. So we funded it at that rate. Bridges, we're doing the Rockford Road Bridge in Plymouth. And remember that the transportation bill has most of the local smaller bridge projects, where we are doing large bridges in our bill, I guess, from this point on. And this was the only bridge we're doing this time. Met Council, we're doing $10 million for their parks program. We have some inflow and infiltration grants. Another very important project, the City of New Hope 50-meter pool, and the City of St. Paul Walk-on Teepee Center. Department of Human Services, again, asset preservation. We are doing regional mental health crisis center grants at $25,100,000. City of Minneapolis Family Partnership at $10 million. Scott County Crisis Center at $1.9 million. If you're wondering, on the mental health crisis centers where they had requested $30 million, what we are doing is making Scott County one of those, and since they had already done or were paying for about two-thirds of it, it actually freed up a little money for us in the other category. But the intent is still to have five crisis centers geographically distributed across the state, and this enabled us to have Scott County be one of them. The White Earth Reservation wants to convert a building site to an opioid treatment center, and so we're doing $900,000 in cash to do that. Asset preservation under Veterans Affairs for $10 million. Corrections, asset preservation at $20 million, and then the St. Cloud interior perimeter fence and the Moose Lake control room renovation. You recall we toured both of those, and I think those are valuable things to do. Under employment economic development, do we have some funding for BDPI? And then a lot of under deed, a lot of more localized projects. Under PFA, we have in this bill, we are funding PFA at the highest level ever funded, at $120 million. We have made some little tweaks to that in the amendment that we passed earlier. And what this does, we now, according to Mr. Freeman of PFA, we can do every project on their list that is ready to go for the next year. There are a couple of projects that have some particular needs that we've made some adjustments for. and we still have some carryover money for next year. PFA, very important project, very important across the state of Minnesota to deal with our wastewater and our clean water issues that we do have. We have, under Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, $6,700,000. Minnesota Historical Society, the Fort Snelling Visitor Center. I should have mentioned earlier that we also are doing the Pillsbury Hall at the University of Minnesota. But Fort Snelling at $30 million, Historic Sites Preservation at $10 million. And that pretty much is the highlights of the bill. We are spending $825 million in GO bonds and appropriation bonds, $50 million. And user financing, $62,620,000. So, that pretty much is it.
All right, Chair Dean, we have, Chair Erdahl, we have two individuals who requested to testify, Commissioner Franz and the Assistant Commissioner of the MPCA. I'll call Commissioner Franz from MMB forward. Commissioner Franz, welcome back to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the Ways and Means. It's good to be back. My name is Myron Franz, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget, and I'm happy to sit here with Chair Erdahl and talk a little bit about his bill. I really wanted to just talk about two issues today, and number one was some of the school grant provisions in the bill, some technical concerns we have, and then obviously a little bit about the size. But primarily what I wanted to talk about in House File 4404, the House, the Senate, and the governor all have shared commitments about safer schools. I think we all agree the need to do something. And the key is that the governor proposed $19.8 million in his supplemental budget to give general fund authorization to local schools and also provide more authorization for them to use their funds for safe schools activities. And also I want to commend Chair Loon for the work that her committee has done as well, with about $28.2 million of general fund resources for safe schools. So we clearly, the governor clearly supports providing resources for schools to provide for increased safety. And today's bill, for today's hearing, the bonding bill creates Safe Schools Grant Program using general obligation bond proceeds. So we sincerely appreciate the effort that Chair Erdahl for the additional commitment. We just want to talk a little bit about some of the legal problems that we might have in that area using funds, general obligation funds for local schools. This committee, and I know Chair Erdahl's committee, knows that typically we do not use general obligation bonds for local school districts. That's been considered a local project. There are special funding mechanisms for that, but it also creates some legal issues. We've been working, MMB staff has been working with the legislative staff to communicate our concerns. The first challenge, there's really two challenges here. The first challenge is the Minnesota Constitution requires that all general obligation bond finance expenditures must be of a capital nature. House File 4404 provides only general direction and is permissive in nature. It states that the grants may be used to pre-design, design, construct, furnish, and equip school facilities. The bill, unfortunately, lacks any specificity on the types of projects that could be funded, and as a result, we're concerned that some school safety improvements might not meet the definitional requirements of a capital project. Under constitutional principles, to be a capital expenditure and eligible for general obligation bond funding, the buildings must already be owned, and the expenditure must, number one, comprise a substantial improvement or expansion of the building. Number two, it must extend the useful life or substantially increase the value of the building. And number three, it must not be predictable or recurring. So equipment that's acquired or installed independent of any acquisition or construction project with a useful life of less than 10 years does not qualify as capital expenditures under general obligation bonds. Also, technology upgrades, for example, to buildings are not always eligible expenditures. In order for technology upgrades to qualify as a general obligation expenditure, they must comprise a program of substantial technological upgrade to a building. Some of the school improvements, safety improvements have been highlighted by the media range from construction of new secure entryways, specialized glass, high-tech cameras, wired doors, alarms, and electronic locks. Many of these expenditures do not qualify as an eligible capital expenditure based upon the criteria that I've just mentioned. So without further direction from the legislature, MMB is not going to be able to determine whether the work would actually qualify in some cases. We just want to make sure that if a school district pursues state funding under this program, that they have the qualifications or and criteria are clearly set out so they can meet those qualifications. But even if that's addressed, there's yet another problem with using this for locally owned facilities. The second challenge that I want to mention is there are significant restrictions in the Minnesota Constitution, state statute, and the Internal Revenue Code, as well as tax regulations that are placed on any facility that receives general obligation bonds. Now, these restrictions may not be acceptable or workable for a local school district. Property acquired or improved with general obligation bond proceeds becomes state bond finance property. And under that, under the Minnesota Constitution, state statutes require that the property's useful life must remain in that particular use, not just when the bonds are repaid. So once a general obligation bond is used to improve a building, a statutory lien attaches to the building and requires that in the event of a future sale of the building during the 125% time period, the state will get repaid first. Now, this statutory lien may conflict with other local financings that school district has already undertaken, particularly if the school facility has been mortgaged or otherwise pledged as security. So these restrictions, these legal restrictions, may also preclude some schools from consolidating or selling off some unneeded buildings without the consent of MMB or repayment of the grant funds, placing a lot of restrictions on local facilities. Additionally, if a school district enters into a lease, management contract, or some kind of similar arrangement in regards to state bond finance property, those agreements will be subject to MMB's approval. The specifics of those agreements will be limited as to the term and ability of the school to finance. So in summary, we have some concerns about will they qualify as capital expenditures, and number two, are the school districts really able and prepared to take on these new to them restrictions in the ability for them to manage their facilities? So those are the concerns. We'll continue to work with the staff of the committee and Chair Erdahl's committee. We just want to make sure that the extent that there is funding provided is accessible and can be used appropriately. I'm going to segue to another issue unless anyone has any questions about that, Mr. Chair.
Questions for Commissioner France, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative or Commissioner, nothing that you've said in the description of the improvements to the buildings would be different from other improvements to other state-owned buildings. On you know, the obviously the properties owned and buildings are owned by the government, which is the primary criteria for GO bonds. And for the improvements that we're looking at, the ones that you've described, I've seen bonded for routinely, whether it be hardening of the building improvements or other upgrades. So that doesn't seem to be anything new or different. And the improvements and the restrictions on resale for the property would be no different than any other state building. So it's just a little puzzling is for MMB's requirements on upgrades would be no different than a DNR building, for example. So I'm just a little curious as to why there would be apprehension, and if so, on a specific project, those all have to be approved by MMB anyway. So it's just a little odd. Maybe you can clarify exactly what your concerns are that would be different.
Commissioner France.
Mr. Chair, Representative, typically general obligation bonds have not been, or typically, rarely have general obligation bonds been used for local school districts. So you're right that a state agency is used to doing, or a local county or a city, they're used to these kind of requirements or bonding requirements, but the school districts are not. So this is entering into a new area of general obligation funding for local school districts, which has typically been handled by the local school district. So it's just really, we want to make it really clear that this general obligation financing is a new level of restriction, a new set of circumstances that they're not accustomed to using. So that's our concern, Representative.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Commissioner, you said that it is rarely used. So give me an example of where it has been used.
Commissioner Frank.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I asked that question and no one could remember the last time.
I can help.
Mr. Chairman, I can help.
All right, Representative Erdahl.
When I am home and I get up in the morning and look across the cornfields, there's the ACGC school, which was built with general obligation bonds. There was a provision at one time, Commissioner, maybe it still is on the books, I don't know, but if three or more school districts combined, they were eligible for general obligation bonds. And so the school that I live by was an example of this. Also, we do a maximum effort bonds, about $305 million since 1959 to schools. So there are examples across the state where GO bonds are used for public schools.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe that, and maybe Chair Erdahl can help me with this, the improvements that were made at the Red Lake School after the tragedy that they had, I believe that those were GO bonds as well. Is that correct?
I believe so.
Chair Erdahl.
So,
thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate the conversation here, Commissioner Franz, but I don't think the sky is falling. Thank you.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Commissioner, I did ask nonpartisan staff to look into this because I approached Chair Erdahl about this bonding for school safety, and our nonpartisan staff did some research into instances in which GO bonds have been used for schools. I'd be happy to make this available to the rest of the committee members if we could have a page make copies, but basically, a number of times we have used bonding for schools. I'll just go very quickly through a list. Maximum effort loans, capital loans, $300 million since the inception of that. And basically, this is bonding for schools that we know those districts are likely not able to pay back. They're just too property poor. Tax poor to be able to do it. And so we've done $300 million of those. The Red Lake School District is listed in the bonding bill. We've bonded for them in the past. The Net Lake School District in 2006. The cooperative facility grants, we've done $30 million of those between 1988 and 1994 to pay for a portion of a new school facility. Let's see. $40 million for integration and desegregation programs. You'll remember the WEMEP and the East Metro District schools. In fact, one of those schools we actually sold last year as part of our bill, the Crosswind School. And I know there were objections by, I think, the administration at that time that this was something we couldn't do. But it was possible. Nobody wanted to continue running the school, so we were able to sell it, and the St. Paul School District was interested in purchasing it. School facility accessibility grants. We have made grants through bonding to school to do accessibility improvements, I assume, for students with disabilities and that. I can go on. So this has been done a number of times in the past, and I think this is an appropriate time to do that again as we help schools improve the physical safety of their buildings, something I know the governor shares as a priority with the legislature.
Chair Erdahl.
Mr. Chairman, and let me just assure Commissioner Franz that if there's a need for some clarification on this, that we're certainly willing to work with his department about this.
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I appreciate the comments, but what you were describing are loans and grants, and the maximum effort is a loan program. Those are all programs designed to provide funding to schools, but not through the normal general obligation process. So you're exactly right. To the extent there are grants for programs or there are loans for schools that can't afford to do it, that's a different way to provide the local funding. This is a little bit different, and we just want to make sure we work with Chair Erdahl so that the schools that want to take advantage of this know that they're signing up for a rather unique set of circumstances.
Well, Commissioner France, I guess I think that, I mean, maximum effort loans are general obligation bonds. and I think particularly the accessibility grants that Representative Loon mentioned seem in many ways to be very similar to this in terms of not being particularly large grants, but smaller bond-funded grants that would go to a school to, you know, make some other capital improvements to it for accessibility issues. But to the extent that there are, you know, language issues here, I think that Chair Erdahl certainly, as he indicated, willing to work with you. One other question I do have is, you mentioned something about 125% of the time period or something like that in terms of having to pay the bonds off. Could you clarify what that is? I didn't quite catch that.
Mr. Chair, so typically what happens is once a general obligation bond is used to improve a building, the statutory lien that attaches to that building requires that in the event of a future sale of the building during this 125% time period, and the 125% time period goes toward the life of the property based on what the useful life of the property is. So there's a determination at the time that the upgrade is made about what would be the lifetime of that property with 125% of the expected life of the property. So that's that 125% time period. It just goes on beyond the sale, the repayment of the bonds. So it's another measuring stick that we have to go by.
And, Commissioner, do you know what's typically the longest life of a property that you've seen on something like this? Well, not particularly the school safety bonds, since they're new, but a different building, for example. Is it, you know, we issue bonds for 20 years, so 125% would be 25 years. Would that be typical?
Mr. Chair, yeah, I've seen anywhere from 20 to 30 years, and then you have to add the 125% calculation of that. 20 or 30 years is a typical life of a building.
Okay. Well, I think that's interesting just to know that it's not a permanent sort of lien, but it expires after certainly a long time, but not a permanent time. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was just going to say I was on the conference committee when the schools that Representative Erdahl referred to. And I think we had a limited number. It was either three or five. I know one was out near Atwater, another one out by Morris. The one that you referenced, that would be three. There may have been as many as five. And just as a little footnote, we didn't use the word. We talked about cooperation and so on. School consolidation was a real hot-button issue at the time. So schools who were willing to join together, three or more, received state funding, and the state literally built those schools if they joined together. There still was a lot of controversy because then the big issue became where was that school going to be located when three or more joined together. And some of you shaking your head, yes, you understand that issue. But I just thought I'd footnote that. That was about 25 years ago, I think, that we probably did that.
At least.
Thank you. Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Franz, as you fulfill your role as kind of a fiduciary for the state, have you, and this bill includes nearly $80 million for the University of Minnesota to look after, preserve, fix, renew, and other things to their buildings. I've seen some numbers about the amount of reserves that the University of Minnesota has, and heard from both people inside and outside the university that believes they have the capacity to take care of their own buildings. Have you analyzed that, and what's your sense about that? Why should the taxpayers of Minnesota be paying, borrowing and spending another $80 million for a constitutionally autonomous organization that seems to or may have the ability to pay for its own building maintenance?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm certainly not an authority on the University of Minnesota's financial background. I do know that their reserves that they maintain are long-term reserves that they use for their overall, in addition to cash flow, their overall management of projects and not just building projects, but other responsibilities that they have. But the bonding of the general obligation bonding of buildings and facilities at the University of Minnesota goes back a long way. There's a history of support for the University of Minnesota as well as the Minnesota State. I think the key is certainly they're a constitutionally independent designated entity, but you know we believe that in supporting the general obligation, some of the development of asset preservation as well as some of the new buildings, we believe the state should play an important part, a role in supporting the University of Minnesota in those endeavors. I mean, part of the reason we're able to do and get such good rates on our bond sales is that we collectively go together with Minnesota State, University of Minnesota, and other state agencies to bond as a state and seek those funds in the best, lowest interest rate we can. So we believe that it's important to support the university. The governor has been a very strong supporter of the university. We believe that their financial resources maintain their own financial situation, but we believe we should support them in the asset preservation of the buildings of that university.
Representative Sikorski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Franz. So we've always done it that way, so that's a good reason to do it. That's what I heard. I don't accept that, but I would just ask that your agency take a look at that. I know another member has done some deep dive investigation into their reserves, and they have some very, very, very large reserves. And I've heard from even members of the Regents and others that believe they have the capacity to take care of some of these buildings on their own. And if we are going to be going in and doing another borrow and spend bill here and borrowing and spending and mortgaging the future of our kids and grandkids, and there's another way to do it, and there's a pile of cash sitting at the University of Minnesota, I think it's incumbent upon us and our fiduciary role collectively to analyze that before we continue to do this over and over again just because we've always done it this way. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Sikorski, the request of the university, I don't remember the exact amount. It was over $100 million. I think the governor has like $150, $200 million in HEPR. And so that being the case, if the needs are that much more than the $40 million we're doing, they have plenty of opportunity to do the rest of it, to spend their own money. We're doing $40 million, which is more than was done last time, but it's still, in the eyes of some, not very much. They can still do it.
Representative Sikorski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Erdahl. But needs and wants are a different thing, and you know, the bonding committee goes out around the state and asks individual communities, what would you like in the bonding bill? And it's no different for the University of Minnesota. If they are going to see the ability to bring forward a pile of cash to take care of their facilities that they don't have to pay for out of their funds, are they going to ask for a bigger number or a smaller number? And I'll just leave that rhetorically.
Representative Houseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've seen that a sheet of paper that the member of your caucus has put together. It's probably more appropriate for the Higher Ed Committee eventually to take a look at that. But my understanding, just as one example, there are a number of endowment funds that the university has that are established as a result of contributors to the university, in some case specifically targeted tuition or scholarships for students, and so there's not necessarily flexibility in some of those endowment funds that have been established. But I think it's one of those things that probably the Higher Ed Committee needs to take a look at that sheet of paper and work line by line through what the reality of each of those funds is.
All right. Seeing no further questions, thank you, Commissioner Franz.
Just one more point I wanted to make.
One more point, Commissioner Franz.
And I promise a short point, and maybe no more, unless you'd like a letter instead, Mr. Chair. I don't know.
I think I already got some of those.
But thank you for the opportunity. And, Chair Erdahl and I have spoken, and I've spoken with a number of you as well. And since I'm the only commissioner having the opportunity to testify today, it'd be remiss for me not to mention that we're concerned about, obviously, the size of the bill. And we believe there are a lot of good elements to what Chair Erdahl's put together with the limitation that he has, but we just believe that it really deserves to have more. We believe we can afford it. I do want to just make one plug for the Minnesota Management Budget, and that is we really manage the money very carefully. And Jan Hassmer, the Assistant Commissioner of Debt Management, is here today, but her office over the last, since 2011, we take a careful look at all the bonds that we have outstanding. Whenever we can get a lower rate, we refinance those bonds. We've saved over $300 million in interest just in the last 7 years by managing carefully our portfolio. That adds up to $10 to $20 million a year in savings over the overall debt, which we think helps lend support for doing a larger bonding bill. We believe we can afford it. We believe that the asset preservation that Chair Erdahl has mentioned is clearly there, but it's more. There's more there that needs to be done. And we firmly believe that asset preservation is really the key to going forward. And I just would urge, to the extent the committee can add more to this, we will fully supportive, and the governor obviously would appreciate that as well. So with that, any other questions I'm happy to take, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further questions, thank you, Commissioner France.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
All right. Next I have, I believe it's an assistant commissioner from the MPCA that wanted to testify. I don't have that person's name, so. Welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. Can you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Erdahl and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Lothammer. I'm an assistant commissioner for water at the Pollution Control Agency. Commissioner Stein does apologize that he wasn't able to be here this morning. But I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill. I do want to also call your attention to a letter that Commissioner Stein submitted to the committee this morning that you should have in front of you. We did notice actually that we're missing the second page from this letter, so I apologize for that, and that is being emailed out to the committee. So on the positive side, this bill includes a $6 million bonding appropriation for cleanup of the WD landfill in Andover, and this meets the governor's request for this site. And this is the most contaminated site or most contaminated closed landfill site in the state. So we very much appreciate the funding being provided for that, which will allow removal of the additional contamination and allow completion of that cleanup project. So thank you very much for that. We also do very much support the water infrastructure funding that's being provided to the Public Facilities Authority to help our cities with their water and wastewater infrastructure needs. We are, however, concerned that the bill does not include funding for the freeway landfill and dump cleanup project in Burnsville. Last year, the legislature provided $3 million of the total $90 million that will be needed. That's the estimated cost to clean up this site. This is the largest closed landfill site in Minnesota, and it sits adjacent to the Minnesota River. This year, the governor requested $52.67 million for the next part of the cleanup process. And so as you work through the conference committee process, we urge you to consider adding that needed $52.67 million to the bill so that we can continue with this very important project. Finally, the agency has several concerns about the A8 amendment, lines 3.13 through 4.2, regarding water quality regulation provisions. This language adds a new layer of bureaucracy to the state's water permitting and regulatory processes and functions that will slow down our work and potentially expose the state to additional liability. We already have a robust stakeholder process for both permitting and also for developing water quality standards and regulations. It includes public notice and comment, pre-public notice to permitting facilities. We receive comments and we make many changes to our proposals based on those comments that we receive. This language, however, would cause delays in that permitting process at a time when we're striving to speed up that process to meet the needs of Minnesota cities and businesses that are looking to expand and add jobs and add new activities. In 2011, Governor Dayton actually set a 150-day permitting timeline for those permits that add jobs or add growth in Minnesota. And we're meeting that 150-day goal 95% of the time. And we're working hard to get to that additional 5%. This language would potentially slow down this progress and not allow us to meet those needs that Minnesota cities and businesses have expressed eloquently to the agency and to the governor. New in this version of the language is a competitive grant process at the Department of Administration. Previous versions of this language directed the funding directly to one entity, the Minnesota Environmental Science and Economic Review Board, or MESRB. So we do appreciate the addition of higher education as a potential recipient of these funds. However, this version allows for a competitive grant process, but it has very specific eligibility criteria in lines 3.16 to 3.22, applying to joint powers boards being eligible for the funding. And of the 10 or so joint powers boards that participate regularly in the agency's regulatory activities, we're not aware of any board other than the Minnesota Environmental Science and Economic Review Board that would meet those eligibility criteria. That then leads to the final concern that we have about this language, which is it raises fairness questions. Right now, citizens and stakeholders provide their input into the regulatory process without the support, the financial support of the Minnesota legislature. This language would direct a select few stakeholders to report both to the agency and to the legislature separately from the existing processes that exist in Minnesota statute and rules for participating in that process, both rulemaking and also permitting. This preferential treatment will confuse the public record and could result in legal challenges that would add additional costs and delays to our processes. Now, I want to be clear that cities and sanitary districts are on the front lines of providing clean water to Minnesota, and we very much appreciate and value the work that they do and their expertise and their voice in the process. Across Minnesota, municipal wastewater treatment operators are doing a great job in operating the facilities that they have. And contrary to the testimony that you may have heard at previous hearings or in other committees, we have a strong track record of working collaboratively with cities to achieve our shared goals of clean water and fiscal responsibility. And I do direct your attention to the handout that was included with the letter, which on the back just gives a smattering of those activities that are underway, working collaboratively with cities and sanitary districts on those clean water goals, and also on delivering that clean water in a cost-effective manner. The language in the A8 Amendment does nothing to enhance that ongoing effort, and instead it provides very real risks for delay and additional uncertainty and litigation. Therefore, for these reasons, Mr. Chair, we oppose that language in the A8 Amendment, and with that, I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Well, Assistant Commissioner Lothammer, I guess just so we're clear, we've adopted the A8 Amendment as this goes in the conference, so Chair Erdahl and others know your position, the administration's position. You don't like the language in the A8 Amendment. You like the language that was in the bill that it replaced better. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, no. We believe that the A8 amendment actually improves the language in the original bill a little bit by providing that opportunity, especially with the oral amendment for Minnesota higher education participating in the process. But our concerns about preferential treatments, a lack of fairness, and the potential for litigation and delays apply to both versions. So we are concerned about the A8 amendment as well as the original language.
So you like the A8 better than the original language?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we like it better, but we still object to the language. We're still concerned about the language.
All right. Okay. Just wanted to be clear. Okay. Other questions for Commissioner Lothammer?
Mr. Chairman.
Chair Erdahl.
If I could just respond a little bit. Costs are becoming exorbitant for our small towns in complying with these MPCA regulations. And all we're doing with this is trying to maybe take a step back and look at how this is happening and why this is happening. Essentially, what this establishes is a pilot program for 3 years in which we take a look at the permitting, and I don't really see that this necessarily has to slow things down. And if it did, I think a lot of cities are willing to wait just a little longer if it's going to save them some money. But again, I don't think it needs to. But again, we're just saying we've got some cost problems. Let's take a look. Let's examine the permitting process to make sure that that's not contributing to it. Again, a 3-year pilot program, and you know, let's see if some improvements can be made.
Any questions for Commissioner Lothammer? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lothammer, I'm curious about the freeway. I was under the impression that, from what I remember in committee this year and last year, that the need at freeway in this upcoming fiscal year was going to be basically just for site investigations. And I'm somewhat surprised by the $52 million. Can you give me some clarity, please? I don't even know if you can use $52.8 million in the next year because you're just doing site investigations at this time, if memory serves me correctly.
Ms. Lothammer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, if I could, I'd like to have Greta Gauthier respond to that question since she has a lot more of the details about the freeway landfill.
Ms. Gauthier, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Fabian. Last year, as you know, there was a freeway bill, and the legislature provided $3 million for us to start and to get going on that final sampling, trenching, and design, and trying to determine the extent and the magnitude of the contamination and design the cleanup. So my understanding is that we have the 30% engineering design completed, and we're working forward from that now. But the $52.67 million would be to actually begin the cleanup and start the work. So that is going to be a multi-year process. But in order to get that work done and be able to keep that work rolling, we need to get that large amount of money in. We have to hire numerous contractors. Sometimes the ones we have to bid for operate. There are only a few in the United States, so we have to have them coordinate, having them come from a great distance sometimes and so forth. Also, once we get this site open, we don't want to leave it open for any long period of time, as we want to get it taken care of and closed back up again as soon as possible.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what's the timeline for when you would actually start cleanup?
Ms. Gauthier.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fabian, thank you for that question. Unfortunately, I don't have that timeline with me right now, but I am happy to send it to you. Okay. Thank you.
Oh, Representative Fabian.
Just and a quick follow-up with regards to some of the provisions in the bill that Chair Erdahl and so forth has, the pilot project. Obviously, it's been a concern of mine for a long time about, you know, the permitting process, and I understand all that and the costs and so forth. Yesterday, we had a lively debate on the House floor with regards to regulatory certainty. MPCA supports that. We're trying to create a situation where if somebody meets the standards today and the investment is made to bring their facilities up to standards, MPCA supports that 16-year regulatory certainty, correct?
Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Fabian. Representative Fabian, last year when that bill came up in the legislature, we were neutral on it, and I do believe, I will double check, but I do believe I testified that we were neutral on it again this year. We are not opposed to it.
Thank you.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and a question for Chairman Erdahl. Is your bill in balance?
Chair Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. Representative Davids, yes, it is.
Then you met the requirements of the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the full cost of this is a five-year project, and the full cost is not the 50, but $86 million. So they would come back a second time for another 30-some. And one of the concerns that some of us who have been trying to make those numbers work are concerned about is the owner, who continues and in the past has been somewhat uncooperative. There have been other opportunities for this. And I think there's a concern that if the state spends $86 million to clean this up, this is now, given where it is, a marvelous development opportunity for an owner to make a lot of money in development of that property. And in our minds, we can't kind of separate those two things. It complicates the decision about going ahead with $86
million. Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hausman. Yes, and actually since we quoted the 86, we've now had to increase it to $90 million. the more we get into the site, the more concerns and problems we are finding. So, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hausman, we don't know how much of this site will be, quote-unquote, developable once it is cleaned up. It's true. It sits right on I-35, right, where I-35 crosses the Minnesota River. This site is the southwest quadrant of that intersection of the river and the interstate. And there is commercial development to the south adjacent to the freeway dump. We don't know yet how much of it will be developable, and we won't know until we finish our determination of the extent of the contamination. We are finding that where the boundary of the landfill is supposed to be, it's not, and there's more trash going past where the boundary has been delineated in the past. So we don't know yet what will be developable. It's possible there could be a small strip of land along I-35. It's possible that there could be where the dump is today. We may have to remove all of that and put it over on top of the landfill. But not all of it will be developable, only a small portion of it. I can tell you that because most of it is, this is 5 million cubic feet of trash, Mr. Chairman, so you can't build on top of that.
Representative Guinness.
Thank you. In the closed landfill program, are there other instances where the property now is the state's? And
so, Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, there are different models for or kind of different specifics that go into each of those closed landfills that the state has responsibility for. But I do want to make the point that the closed landfill program does have provisions within that program to address ownership questions and to ensure that the state's investment is protected in addressing these particular problem landfills. But it can be very specific to what is the situation with a given site. And we can certainly provide more information to the committee about how that state interest is protected.
Other questions for the witnesses? I see none. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. We had no other witnesses that requested to testify, so we'll go to discussion of the bill. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I first want to just say to the author, he had a very difficult job writing a bill, given the size of the bill that he had, and I think what is before us is a good bill with balance, as he has suggested. And I particularly want to call out a couple of things under higher education. I know the English department faculty, after many years of working for a Pillsbury Hall renewal, are relieved that that is going to happen. The author stuck to the priorities of Minnesota State, and I know that that is appreciated. And I think we just should acknowledge that every one of those campus projects we do, there is an amount of deferred maintenance that gets removed once that project is done. So the impact on deferred maintenance really goes beyond the $40 million shown for HEPR. But I think we would all acknowledge that should a miracle happen, and there is more bonding capacity that that HEPR for the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State would certainly be improved, as would perhaps a couple of other things that I'll just mention for should there be an opportunity in the next week. One of those is RIM under the Bowser. They had requested $30 million. That would leverage $69.9 million of USDA funds. Since we're only a third of the way there, we do lose some opportunity to maximize federal match dollars. The program's voluntary, and I understand there are already $55 million in applications. Housing, we know, is a statewide crisis, and MHFA requested $30 million for public housing rehab. We're not quite there with 6.7. Public housing serves some of the lowest income residents of the state, and all over the state there are waiting lists on those for those programs, and they serve seniors, they serve persons with disabilities, they serve families with children. Nearly 75% of the residents have incomes under $15,000 per year. So we have some, certainly our work cut out for us. Because it's now become the transportation bill with that amendment, I just want to call out that MnDOT's number one request is the Stone Arch Bridge, which may have to be closed, and MnDOT's number two request is the Rochester Bus Garage, and we haven't quite accomplished MnDOT's number one and number two priority. The two that I would also just note in their absence are Safe Routes to School, which, again, people all over the state understand the importance of. And then those of us who toured St. Peter know that we stood in a kitchen where the temperatures were intolerable, and so it's an amount for the dietary building that at some point I'm hoping that we can do. Representative Davids, you and I know, are very disappointed that we have not finished the Chatfield Center for the Arts. We've done phase one, and they're patiently waiting to finish, and I hoped that maybe it would be in this one. But again, because it's become the transportation bill, I just should also point out that in this bill there is no passenger rail and there is no funding for arterial bus rapid transit, let alone any rail projects. Last year, Charlie Weaver and Doug Loon gave a compelling commentary in the paper in which they said we need our transportation system requires roads, bridges, and transit. And that message is not heard by this body. And we're falling behind our economic competitors. We're falling behind our Midwest economic developers. We're falling behind centers, cities, and states governed by Republican mayors and governors. So Michigan and Indiana and Illinois and Kansas City and St. Louis and Denver and Wichita, Kansas, and cities in Texas, they are all moving ahead. They are all accepting federal funds. They all know their people want transportation alternatives at both ends of the age spectrum, those who are young and whether because of college debts they can't afford a car or don't want to add that burden, and at the other end, those seniors who really don't want to or can't drive anymore. They want to still be mobile. So because it's now become the transportation bill, I felt I just needed to acknowledge that there are some unfunded areas as a result, and that piece of our solution isn't quite there yet. But I appreciate very much the underlying bill in which for $825 million is a good bill.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just as a little follow-up, I have a question of you or the staff, because I was hopeful when somebody referenced Miracle earlier. I was hopeful that I would see on the agenda the budget resolution to see the bill grow a bit. And like Representative Hausman, I've got no argument with what's been done with the 825. But from the get-go, when we adopted the budget resolution, some of us were concerned about the size of the bill. And my question of you, Mr. Chairman, or of the staff, you know, you had the other bills category, and pensions was $27 million, and opioids, if you fund those out of the general fund, would be $20 million. That would leave, on the face of it, about $3 million. But I'm not sure what you're going to do with the opioids. You know, they're couple of other, there's a fee that's being talked about, not necessarily the penny a pill. I think that conversation has been more on the Senate side. But my question is, where do we stand currently as this bill leaves committee in terms of what remains potentially on the bottom line to hopefully perhaps expand this bill?
Representative Carlson, I don't have an exact number off the top of my head. Maybe I can call on Mr. Mark to give you the exact number.
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, at this point, there's about $50,400,000 left, not including the pension bill. The pension bill would take $27 million of that amount. Yeah. So
it's $50 million that's left on the bottom line. That was the number I just used, and then you subtract the pension bill, and then the opioid crisis. hopefully is going to be resolved, and the question there is whether there will be a fee charged, whether there is going to be the penny of a pill that's removed from the bill, or whether the general fund is being used. But if the general fund is being used, then in my mind there would be $3 million left for sure for debt service, unless there's something that's in the pipeline that you're aware of that I'm not.
Well, I guess what I'd say, Representative Carlson, is first of all, we did have $6.5 billion roughly, if I recall, for opioids in the Health and Human Services bill. But we will be seeing a opioid bill by Representative Baker here in the very near future, so watch for your postings as to when we're going to hear that. I don't have an exact number of how many dollars that would be. I guess I don't think we should spend every last dollar that's in that other bills category. I mean, I'd like to see some additional money on the bottom line. I think if Commissioner Franz was around here, he'd come up and tell you that he'd still like to see some money on the bottom line, too. But anyway, that kind of gives you the update of where we are right now.
Well, you did have the $75 million, Mr. Chairman, that you were putting back into the reserve. That would be money, in a sense, on the bottom line. I'm talking just the budget resolution and right. What you set aside for pending spending purposes. The reason I raised that question, there would be potentially some additional money for debt service, and we could grow the bill. The question would be where that happens. I was hopeful it would happen here this morning, but obviously the budget resolution wasn't put on the agenda, so I assumed then that you weren't going to do it. There's another step in the process, the House floor, because some of us are advocates of trying to address some of the issues that Representative Houseman just outlined that should be or could be addressed if we had a little more money available for the debt service.
Well, and I guess
but I don't think you're saying I'm incorrect that there's at least $3 million there, and depending on how the opioids are handled, perhaps even several million more if we use another revenue stream to deal with the opioid crisis.
Well, Representative Carlson, you are correct that there's additional money there. I guess I'm hoping that we will be leaving some additional money on the bottom line. You know, we had a $1 billion bonding bill last year. If you look at the spreadsheet, the total amount of spending, if you add up everything, the user financing and so forth, and this doesn't even include the trunk highway money that went into it now, is $966 million. So we are, even with this bill, which you are saying is, you know, in your view, I guess maybe not large enough, we've got a very substantial bill here.
And Mr. Chair, I want to make it clear I'm not arguing about what Chair Erdahl did with the 825. He's aware, you're aware, because I've spoken to this issue before, that I am an advocate for a little larger bill. But thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Erdahl, for working on deferred maintenance. What I am missing here, though, is the context. Do you have, and this is probably a question for the Chair, do you have a spreadsheet that shows what our outstanding deferred maintenance is in this state, not just from the universities and the state college systems, but, say, from DNR, and other deferred maintenances, so we can see, are we making good inroads? Are we falling behind? I can't tell. So I'm asking if you have that spreadsheet that you could share.
Well, Representative Wagenius, I don't have that spreadsheet with me. I've seen various spreadsheets like that from the different agencies in the past. I Representative Erdahl might have more immediate access to them if you wanted to talk to him offline. But certainly we, even with the very significant contribution that Representative Erdahl is making with the bill he's authored here to deferred maintenance, there is certainly still a lot of deferred maintenance left to be done. And there you know, that remains a outstanding problem that we've had for as long as I've been in the legislature and probably as long as you've been too, Representative Wagenius.
Well, it does seem that it is the responsibility of this committee, because it's both cash and bonding that we can use to resolve the deferred maintenance. It would be good for this committee to have a spreadsheet compiling the underlying information that you have and put it together so we can see where we are and on what track we would need to be to reasonably handle the deferred maintenance we have. I mean, it does seem that that is the responsibility of this committee, and I hope the chair could produce something like that for us.
Representative Erdahl, then Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Wagenius. Just a short conversation I had with nonpartisan staff. They say that admin does have something along these lines, but it's fairly general. So I don't know if you'll get the specificity that you want, but there is something along those lines.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, perhaps if admin could share that with this committee, that would be helpful, and to give us a sense of what range. I mean, specificity is not absolutely necessary, but we do have to have understanding of range. Is this like plus or minus 10 or plus or minus 40?
No,
it would be helpful to
Chair Erdahl.
Thank you. I'll ask for that.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson. All right. Other discussion or questions for Chair Erdahl?
He does not want that question.
Chair Erdahl, closing comments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and I appreciate the comments about the bill and the discussion. I think it's a good bill, and I appreciate your support.
All right. With that, Chair Erdahl renews his motion that House File 4404, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 4404, as amended, is referred to the General Register. All right, members, again, we have another meeting at 8 in the morning tomorrow. Same room. Sorry. Watch your calendar for the agenda, and we will see you on the floor and tomorrow.
And then DFLers will meet at 2 o'clock, 272 today.
DFLers are meeting at 2 o'clock, room 272. Republicans are meeting at 2 o'clock, room 400 North. Meeting adjourned.